Welcome to Sonic's Flight, the podcast devoted to all things Sonics. Sonic's Flight is a monthly podcast discussing current events, news, and topics of interest to the Sonics community. We aim to entertain and educate builders and pilots of Sonics aircraft designs, inspiring them to complete and operate their aircraft safely and efficiently. Welcome to Sonic's Flight, the monthly show where we talk all things Sonics. This is episode number 9, the landing gear episode. Tonight we'll discuss the options and decisions that a builder has to face with their project, including possible options you may want to implement based on your mission or your desired use for the Sonics. We'll talk tips and tricks in getting a good landing gear installation. So joining me, as usual, is my cohorts, Gary Motley and John Gillis. Gary's a longtime pilot, former CFI, has thousands of hours of GA flying, and over 600 hours on his Aero V Sonics based in Denver. Gary, you've been flying lately?
Oh, absolutely. I was out about 2 hours out in the Rocky Mountains on a wonderful day this morning.
All right. Well, good to hear you're getting out and about. And John Gillis. John flies his Jabiru-powered YX from Colorado Springs. Has quite a bit of experience with custom mods on his YX. John, you fly today also?
Yes, I did. I got about an hour and a half in this morning. Not with Gary, though.
Different directions today, huh?
Yeah, I played out east and did a few aerobatics and just yanked and banked and burned some gas. It was fun.
It's a good use of avgas, I have to agree. Helping us through this topic of landing gear is our guest, Bob Micah. Bob is builder of KD, Sonics 178. That's a plans-built Aero-V tail dragger Sonics. Bob's an early plans builder and made all the parts for his airplane except the welded components, his fuel tank, his canopy, and his cowling. Like Bob likes to mention, he built back in the day when you even had to cut your own spar caps. They sent you a truckload of raw aluminum ore, and you had to forge the casting and cut your spar cap. So nobody has to do that anymore. If you want to know how to do it, talk to Bob. He's your man. Bob, how's it going?
It's going great. The hard part was training the oxen to pull the aluminum billet through the die. That was the hard part. But the oxen were tasty after we got that part done.
Hey, there's an upside to everything, right?
That's right.
So Bob and I got together today with some other Kansas City area Sonics pilots and had a little impromptu get-together, which we're calling the 2016 Kansas City Turkey Shoot. Everybody says, why the turkey shoot? Well, because we make bad landings and shoot the breeze. So that seemed like a pretty good you put a bunch of turkeys in the same room, and that's what happens. So, Bob, thanks for sticking around and knocking out this episode. It's been a really good visit here in Kansas City, and I'm glad we got a chance to hang out.
Yeah, I had a great time.
All right, so we'll do a trip report on sonicsbuilders.net. You guys can go find it there. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. And Isaac, the official photographer of the 2016 Turkey Shoot, says he's working on a little YouTube picture video montage. So when that's done, we'll go back in and put a link to that as well. So for anybody out there in the Kansas City area that missed it, catch us again next time. And that'll be in probably May timeframe for the 2017 Midwest Sonics Gathering. All right. Well, with that out of the way, let's go over a couple of news topics here. So first up is the ADS-B issue going on with NavWorks. And John, you're tracking this issue pretty close. Why don't you bring us up to speed on what's happening?
Yeah, well, it turns out NavWorks was, from what I understand, they had a certified and an experimental version of their transponder, their squitter. And something came about where the FAA was questioning the quality of their GPS signal or reporting, whether it was hardware or software. There was some finger pointing. The FAA wasn't satisfied with NavWorks' response and placed an emergency order to have all units removed. So a few of our Sonics guys on the bulletin have these units. Carl Benda has one in his Cessna 175. And it looks like they may be out of luck that they bought a paperweight, and who knows if NavWorks is going to survive this or not.
So in the interim, while they fight this out, what are people supposed to do with their NavWorks receivers?
Right now, they're supposed to deinstall them because I from what I understand, the regulation says if you have one installed, you must turn it on. And so you can't just turn it off and not use it. Basically what it's doing is there's an integrity, a location integrity bit that's set on the transmission to the ADS-B towers that tells how well the how much faith they have in your position reporting. And NavWorks was incorrectly encoding it that they were at a greater integrity or a greater accuracy than they actually were. Which you can imagine that can cause a problem if we're relying on them reporting an accurate position and they're not. And that's what got the FAA rather upset about it. So they shouldn't be operating it if they're broadcasting an incorrect integrity level.
So it sounds like this is a case where there may or may not be anything wrong with the box itself, but it's definitely in the approval process. The FAA said, until you satisfy our inquiry, we're shutting you down.
Yeah, well, it was approved. It was certified, actually. And then this is all after the fact that they can't prove that they're meeting their certification levels. So who knows if this is going to have an impact on other people. I use SkyGuard. I'm hoping it's not pulled into this. I hope that they have the right chipset. There's other solutions out there, but this is definitely a wait and see on the NavWorks.
Yeah, so this is the obvious comment here. When the FAA stands back and shrugs their shoulders and says, how come nobody wants to race out and be an early adopter of ADS-B technology? This is exactly what people are worried about. They don't want to get stuck on the bleeding edge of technology, only to find that they contributed to advancing our common knowledge out of their own pocket.
Right. We knew that there was going to be some teething pains. Hopefully these aren't really painful teething pains and very expensive for some of our early adopters.
Well, perhaps this will shake out with a firmware upload and they'll get it all sorted out.
Yeah, I'm hoping so.
Well, moving on, there was a discussion going on the last week or two on the sonicsbuilders.net talking about brakes. People talking about brakes holding at full power and what are they doing and back and forth. Although we're not going to go into it in this episode, that is a future topic that we're going to circle back to, which is all your braking options. So we'll touch on it here. We'll come back to it in a future episode very soon. I think the only thing I wanted to kind of call out on this is for anybody that's having braking problems, there is a wide variety of experiences out there. Some people install them and they work great, whether they're mechanical or hydraulic or whatever. And then for every one of those people, there are someone who installs it and they can't make it work right for anything. Again, cable, hydraulic, doesn't matter. So if you're having a problem with your brakes, find a builder who has had good experience and pick their brain and figure out what are they doing different than you are, because it's probably, very likely, simply a setup. There's probably something in there that you need to do. Follow their example, figure out their technique and use it. And that's probably going to give you satisfactory performance. What do you guys think?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's almost always options to tweak something.
I agree.
And Bob, you have the cable brakes, and you've been flying them for years now, and you say they're working just great.
Yeah, I've got the machine drums and the cable. You know, when you land at 50 miles an hour, I put on the brakes, and I stop. And they squeal kind of funny, but as I was telling you today, that used to bother me until when I was down in Sun and Fun and I was listening to the B-17 taxi around and it made the same squeal. So now I think, well, that's just the B-17 sound. So that's it.
Now, did you have to tweak yours or did they pretty much work well right from the original install?
They worked well from the original install. One time I got some grease on them, from the, when I redid my, or took off my wheels for some reason, I can't remember, but I got a little grease squeezed out when I re-greased the bearings, and that stuck and it would grab. So then I just took everything apart, cleaned it up, and since then I haven't had any trouble.
Yeah, you know, but the grease worked great for cutting the squeal, though, didn't it?
Actually, no, it made it worse.
Okay.
But, which is one of the reasons I knew I had a problem. But, I haven't had any problems with that. And my buddy Charlie Radford had the standard brakes, not even the machine, just the pressed metal brakes. And he never had any problems with his. One thing, you got to keep them adjusted, you know, just like everything. And they work fine.
Excellent. We'll get into all the details of how exactly to make your standard brakes work and what options there are for hydraulic brakes. We'll go into that in some depth here in one of our future shows. Well, with that, let's jump right into the main topic here, landing gear. And again, our guest, Bob Micah, I'm going to turn it over to you, Bob, and why don't you give us a little bit of your background and your flying experiences, and then we'll dig into this landing gear.
Okay, well, I've been flying since October of 67, mostly in Cherokees and Cessnas, just rental. Finally, I bought a set of plans for an RV4 in the 80s. And started by building a luggage rack for my car because I wanted to learn how to rivet, and built that and figured out that I could afford to build an RV4, but I couldn't afford to fly it. So I sold those plans, and then I waited around and looked at many aircraft, and finally Sonics became available, and I bought my plans on the first day of Oshkosh 1999. I started in September of 99. I finished in 2008, which is 9 years, and it took me that long just because I'm a slow and kind of methodical builder. I did buy the bent metal kit, or the formed metal kit, I guess it's called, with the for the control surfaces and that kind of thing. But mostly I just built the whole thing myself. I think you've got some links that you're going to put on to my website that shows that. And there are also some links that go directly to what we're talking about today.
Yeah, Bob's got numerous photo albums that show every stage of the construction all the way through it. So we'll put links to Bob's photo albums and a few specialty videos we're going to get to in a minute here. We'll put those in the show notes.
Yeah, but the airplane was... you know, I took my time, and the airplane went together fine. And as we all know, the hardest part was the canopy. But I got through that. Flew the airplane. It had a few teething problems. I had to adjust this and that, but nothing really out of the ordinary. Got my 40 hours flown off in June of 2009. Flew it to Oshkosh. And I guess I've been up there every year except last year. I had a conflict last year. Flew it to Sun and Fun. I mean, it just flies along just fine.
And, no, Bob. Sorry, we talked about cutting the spar caps, but I don't think anybody is really tracking. Back up just a little bit and tell us what that means to cut the spar caps.
Well, you get the extrusion. One side of the extrusion is, I think, 3 degrees, and the other is 6 or 7 degrees. So there's a front and back to it. You mark it very carefully with your Sharpie, and then you rig up this rolling gadget and put it through your bandsaw. And cutting, you know, 10 feet of cut both ways on a bandsaw is kind of tricky. It takes all day to do one cut, or it did me anyway. So that's 4 days just cutting it. Then once you get that done, you have to take a Vixen file to it, and you Vixen file all the cut marks off. And, of course, you cut a little bit wider than you need to, and you Vixen file down to the point. And then you've got a spar cap. It's not as hard as it sounds, but it's very, you know, very tedious work. So I'm glad they've supplied those. It's not as bad as the canopy.
Yeah. Every Sonics builder is familiar with the spar caps in the root area that go underneath the spar tunnel. So those extrusions are that width all the way out. They're just a one-size extrusion, and now they come pre-machined to their final dimension. You just pull them out of the box, and you start assembling your spars. Or if you get the pre-built spars, they're obviously already pre-built. But back in the day, they just – whacked off a hunk of spar cap extrusion, stick them in the box, and you had to do everything to them. So that's quite the operation.
Yeah, it was fun. You know, you get the scrap that you have, you got the world's longest tomato steak.
All right, so let's jump into the main reason why we're talking about landing gear. It seems like kind of an odd topic, but there's a lot of little things that you have to consider when you're talking about setting up your project, when you're making decisions for what you're going to buy down the road. So there are several decisions that you need to make, and you probably ought to think about this early on so that you're prepared to make these decisions. You may have a very specific mission in mind, so you may need to think about what type of pavement or grass or gravel that you're going to be operating off of. You may have certain customizations in mind. And then there may be a few issues that the rest of the fleet have experienced with their landing gear, and just being better informed about them is going to help you avoid those down the road. So, again, options and decisions. So the first thing is, you really need to consider your mission, and specifically, what type of surface do you plan on operating off of most of the time? The Sonics will work off of grass. It'll work off of gravel or any type of pavement. And although it's not required to do anything to operate on really any of those surfaces, there are a few things that you may choose to do if you are routinely going to be operating off of rougher surfaces. So specifically, your tailwheel size, your main gear tire size, and then just choosing a tail dragger versus tri gear might factor into that surface consideration.
Well, sure. Would you like to talk about landing gear configuration first or tires first?
Well, let's do configuration. So kick us off, Gary.
Well, of course, you know, we got the two main. We have the traditional tricycle gear with the tail dragger wheel up front, and then, of course, you have the conventional wheel with the tail dragger back in the back. You know, I think you can do almost anything with either one of those two. You know, we've seen a lot of aircraft that, you know, if you're talking about the traditional STOL and Bush stuff, they seem to like the tailwheel configuration for greater prop clearance. But there's also other manufacturers such as the Zena STOL series that use a traditional or a more contemporary tricycle gear, and they seem to get out just about anywhere as well. So, you know, these days I'm not really sure that it's absolutely mandatory that one has to have a tail dragger in order to operate in soft fields. I think it's probably just a pretty much just personal preference, like most things in aviation.
Well, I built mine with the Jabiru tricycle, which has the offset nose wheel on it. And, you know, I kind of was disquieted by some of the flimsiness of it. It just seemed, although I was able to taxi and land and without any problems, it just seemed like it was wobbly. And not quite as stout as, say, a Cessna or another, or even an RV tricycle. So I think the tail dragger is, you know, just a lot more stout. It just feels better.
That's kind of what I was going to say. With proper technique, either one is going to be suitable. But if you think you're going to be landing on a little bit rougher surfaces, the tail dragger is just a little bit more robust. You don't have the chance of bending or breaking off that nose gear. And it allows you to get by with a little bit less than ideal technique.
Well, and here's another thing that maybe people should consider. If you have never or very infrequently gone to rougher fields in the types of aircraft that you're flying now, I think when you start flying in a Sonics, the rougher fields will call to you. Because one, you can get in and out of them, and two, the kind of flying that we usually do in Sonics lends itself to that kind of field. So if you haven't gone to those before, you'll probably end up going to those in the future. Like I said, the tri-gear or the conventional gear works just as fine. We can talk about tire size later, but when you get a Sonics under you, you'll say, you know what, I can go into that field that, you know, some of the guys in the chapter have always talked about. And by God, when you go in there, you'll say, boy, that was fun. I'm going to go back.
Now, John, you started with your tri-gear and converted to the tail dragger. What motivated that?
Well, I got some, I call it bad advice when I was building my Sonics from an RV guy that I really trusted. He said, you know, if you go tail dragger, if you're going to ground loop it, it's when. And he had this really bad attitude towards tail draggers. And I respected his opinion and decided to go ahead. Well, I don't have any tail dragger experience. I'm going to go ahead and build mine tricycle. And I did, and I flew the first 60 hours of it as a tricycle. But then it just kept yearning to me. I loved the look of the tail dragger. And I was going down for a long annual, and I had found a motor mount and decided to go ahead and switch over. And I'm glad I did. Not looking back on that at all.
So having flown the same airplane in both configurations, how would you size up both the tri-gear and the tail dragger?
I think the tri-gear is a little easier to land, well, and take off, because your sight picture is just, it's so conventional with the tricycle. You know, you're not having to look over the nose. You have, your flare is the same sight picture as your approach. And it just is a little easier all around. That's not to say that the conventional gear is difficult. It's just, it's more fun. It's a little more challenging. I don't know. It's a fine flying aircraft either way.
One other consideration, we've been talking about rough fields, but if you're routinely operating in windy conditions or where you can expect a crosswind a good portion of the time, that might be a good mark in favor of the Tri-Gear, because as we saw today, Bob, the Tri-Gear Sonics is a piece of cake in a crosswind.
Yeah, we had Ray Coran came in. Gardner, and we had at least a 15 knot, 90 degree crosswind, and he landed, and he was yawning when he was doing his rollout.
Oh, I'll absolutely concur. I mean, there have been times when I landed in very heavy, even direct down the runway winds, 30, 40 miles an hour. But of course, once you stop and you're lined up with the wind, and you got to make that exit off to the taxiways back to the hangar. There are going to be times when the tower is going to call you and ask you if they want to send somebody out to help tow you in, because you just can't quite, you know, counteract those stiff winds with the tail gear.
So that's kind of the way I view it. In very oversimplified terms, if you want effortless crosswind takeoff and landing performance, the Tri-Gear may really appeal to you. If you want the fun and the challenge and maybe a little bit more robust landing gear for going into those grass fields, then the tail dragger may appeal to you. Either way, you're going to have a great airplane, and you're going to enjoy them both. Okay, let's move into the actual gear legs themselves. So as you all know, the Sonics includes titanium rod, solid rod, non-tapered gear legs. And if you order a kit, that's what you get. They're already in the box, or cut to length, they're ready to go. There are a few things you need to do to properly install them. We'll get to those in just a second. However, there are a few other options out there for gear leg material. Namely, you can source your own titanium rod if you are building from plans and you did not order them from Sonics. There are sources on the internet of titanium rods, so you may order those, in which case fabricating them to the right length and all that is on you. You can cut down an existing tail dragger gear leg to make a tri-gear leg. And John, I think that's what you did on yours, correct?
Yeah, that's what I did when I, my kit came as a tail dragger kit, and I, during the build, switched over to tri-gear. So I cut down the legs.
So if you're looking for tri-gear legs, that may be a source of used legs or something out there that, you might be able to consider. And then the last option that comes to mind is, an aftermarket style gear leg, specifically the Tracy O'Brien gear legs, and those are steel gear legs. And I think they have a couple of things going for them, namely that they're made to work seamlessly with their brake package. And John, that's what you're running currently, correct?
Yeah, when I converted over, I played with the idea of going and buying, you know, replacement titanium legs from Sonics, or do the Tracy O'Briens. And since I was upgrading to the Tracy O'Brien brake package, and they were roughly the same price, I went ahead with the Tracy O'Briens all the way from the motor mount to the tip of the axle.
I don't think that there's really any reason to try and switch from the titanium to the Tracy O'Brien, but if you're buying their brakes anyway and you got to buy new gear legs, it does make a very easy upgrade. You just bolt them in and you're done.
Yeah, there was no fabrication. They just bolt right on. And they're tapered. I think they're a little more, I found them a little softer than the titanium tail dragger Sonics as I've flown. Just a little softer on the bounce.
Okay. And, I think the next option out there is the tailwheel style. So Gary, what tailwheel did you initially start with? And is that what you're flying currently?
Well, of course, initially I started with a very, very small tailwheel that comes with a Sonics kit. I used that for maybe 50 hours or so. But even then, as I was taxing along, as many of us know, you hit any little crack or crevice in the concrete or pavement on the way out, and it's just as if you're putting down a tail hook. It's very disconcerting, very loud banging going back and forth. And it was shortly after that, fortunately, Kip Lorry was coming out with a solution to that. He was welding up some frames that you could replace back there and put a much larger tailwheel on, and I jumped right on that, and I thought that was one of the greatest things that I did with my kit.
Yeah, the lack of clearance back there on the tail is really the smaller diameter tailwheel only has, you know, it's only a 4-inch tailwheel, so you've only got 2 inches from the center bolt possible. And then because the way that caster arm is fabricated, that caster cuts down some of that clearance even further. So on my original tailwheel, I only had about 1 inch between the bolt that held the caster in place and the ground. And if you went over a large crack or anything, that thing would smack into it and bang over cracks. And if you dragged through the softer ground, grass or gravel, you would leave a rut down the middle. Just that little tailwheel just didn't spread the load out, just didn't have an ability to cross those gaps.
And one John, time. As a YX driver, I'm sure you heard a lot of guys that are having those lower tail fins actually ground off as well, weren't you?
Yeah, I know Kip banged his up because there's a ventral fin that you fabricate out of some scrap that you have left over at the end of the build that goes at the bottom of the tail section. And with that smaller tail wheel, you know, any deviation and you'll bang that thing up. After hearing some of those horror stories, I called Kerry up and asked him if I really needed to put that on there, and he said, no, it's just for looks. So it never went on.
One time, Charlie Radford damaged his tailwheel by hitting a steel plate on one of the taxiways. He took off, and after he took off, he found that he only had left rudder. Couldn't have right rudder because it had bent the bolt part somehow, and so he slowly went around Lawrence, Kansas Airport, finally got it back on the ground. We came back, we had to remanufacture it, a little part for him, and so he could fly home. But it's a real danger. It's a real danger unless you get the clearance greater than the original.
Now, Bob, you modified your standard caster to accept a larger tailwheel. Tell us about that.
Well, it's on my website. What I did was I took some 4130 plates. I expanded it. I lowered it a little bit so that I had more clearance. And then I put in a 5-inch tail wheel that I bought. I've got the number there. It's a cast aluminum tail wheel. I had to modify the width of it a little bit using the Scotch-Brite wheel. But it's worked fine. There's, you know, a variety. I had another plastic one that I used, and it worked fine. It was much lighter, but I didn't like its, it wasn't robust enough for me. So I went back to the cast aluminum one, which is a little bit heavier. This was in the day before anybody else had them. I think, Gus had made one and Kip had made one, and I think mine was maybe the third or fourth one. They're all a little bit different, but they all do the same thing. They increase the clearance, and it makes of all of the changes that made the greatest change, especially even on pavement. It's the way to go.
Right. Now you said you angled those new arms that you welded on the caster. You angled it down a little bit.
Yeah, I radiused them, and the radius is on the bottom side. You'll see on my photographs how I did it. I just extended it down a little bit.
Right, and that's a pretty simple way to do that. A larger tailwheel is going to give you better clearance, and angling it down a little bit, it's not going to hurt anything, give you a little bit more clearance yet.
No.
It's a pretty simple modification for your standard caster.
Yep.
So after painting this kind of bleak opinion of the standard caster with the 4-inch tailwheel. Sonics has recognized that a lot of people are somewhat unhappy with this, and they've released a line of upgraded machined aluminum tailwheels, which are really nice. And I have one of the 4-inch machined aluminum tailwheels, and it uses the same standard 4-inch wheel, but it angles the whole caster unit. Instead of being roughly parallel to the ground, it angles it at about a 45-degree angle, and you pick up more clearance just simply on that alone. Works great. It's not very much heavier than the standard unit. Very easy to install. I really like it. The 6-inch model gives you even more ground clearance. And Mike Niedenthal has one on his, and it flies great. And then I think there are a couple other options out there beyond modifying your own or the Sonics machined. And then that is Flyboys at one time was making a breakaway tailwheel. Peter Anson was making a custom tailwheel. John, you've got the Flyboys tailwheel. What do you think of that?
Oh, I love it. It's a 6-inch, and it's a breakaway, so it's direct drive, just like the regular Sonics tailwheel, up to when you get to the full deflection point, then a detent pushes in, and it casters. So you have to have differential brakes, but I can pirouette on one gear now. So that's nice on, especially at my home airport. Our runway is really narrow, and being able to do a 360 within, 10 feet is really quite handy.
Yeah, certainly an advantage. I mean, I'll even have it one time on a very narrow runway. I actually had to get out, shut down the engine, pick up the tail, pull it back in order to get it pivoted around because I just didn't have the room to do that. But you do lose, the direct steerable and real great ground controllability with the Sonics line with the full breakaway. And of course, then you can start to deal with the ground loop issues.
Yeah, on the Flyboys, it actually doesn't break away. It's until you get to the full deflection. So it's not like a typical mall wheel or something that's will break, with force. This one, you have to get it all the way over to the edge before it'll break over. But unfortunately, Flyboys doesn't make them for the Sonics anymore. They're specifically focusing on the RVs now.
Well, there are people out there who have always flown with tow brakes and breakaway tailwheels, and there's a certain segment that's what they're comfortable with, and they want it because, again, they're comfortable with it. My advice to them, if your mission requires it, that's a different story. By all means, if that's what you need to accomplish your mission. Jonathan Wolf flies out of Roosterville here in Kansas City, and he's in the same situation. It's a very narrow runway, and he's got to be able to pivot within the length of the airplane to get line back up. So he has a very legitimate need for something like that. If it's a matter of you want it because you're used to it, well, maybe you ought to rethink that because it's a whole lot simpler and a whole lot easier to stick with what the map that Sonics has laid out. That's my advice on that.
Yeah, and if you do enough planning, if you're landing at a narrow airport, there's usually a big enough turnaround area at the end of the runway. Or just go off piste and, into the weeds a little bit and you can probably get around.
All right, the next consideration is tire size. And so the standard Sonic supplied tire is a 4x5. Is that what that is?
Right.
Okay. And they do have some advantages. They're lightweight. They wear pretty well. And they're extremely affordable. On my airplane, I was planning on flying it off of a dirt and gravel airstrip. I'm no longer flying it off that same airstrip, but I knew right from the start I needed to have something that was going to be easily flown off of the softer surfaces. I wanted to be able to float over sandy pockets, and so I went right with a standard aviation tire, a 5x5, and to me that was worth it. They're a little heavier. They're quite a bit more expensive. They have excellent wear capabilities. I'm still on the first set of tires, and I've got 250 hours on mine. But they do have some significant downsides, and that was my wheel pants took massive modifications to get them to work. And part of that is my brakes, and part of it is just it's a big tire. Gary, what did you do on yours?
Well, again, I went with the standard kit. I used the Chinese tires that came with it, and I'll have to tell you that I have used those up until this very day. I've got over 650 hours, but more importantly, I have 800 or so landings on this original set of tires. And I firmly believe that, I could get easily another couple hundred more landings on these tires. I did, rotate them once. But what I found is that when I go to Oshkosh or some of the off-field areas, I'm requiring almost full power with just myself in the airplane to taxi through the grass at Oshkosh. So I know those little wheels are a certain detriment to the off-field operations. Living here in Colorado, though, surprisingly, we don't have a lot of off-field surfaces. Most of our airports, because of the density altitude, are 10,000 feet and paved. So it really wasn't such an issue. So I got a great set of wearing tires with those original Chinese tires in my locale. But today I went ahead and installed the Tundra tires of the Sonics, which are the 5x5s. I took some pictures, and it's a remarkable size difference. They are a little bit heavier, but even just looking at the nose of the aircraft now, it really stands much taller. And we were talking about sight pictures before. I haven't had a chance to crawl in there yet, but I do suspect that's going to, you know, increase the difficulty trying to look over the nose.
Bob, how are your standard tires holding up?
Well, I don't have standard tires anymore. I started with the standards, and they worked fine. But again, as Gary said, I have a lot of friends on turf fields. So I found that although it works on turf, it's just not happy. And I went my first set of 5x5s. I made a huge mistake and bought retreads and or recaps. And they were out of balance, and I've got a whole couple of videos showing the bad vibration that I got out of balance tires. And I tried to balance them, and they never got totally balanced. And I went to a new 5x5, and I've been very, very happy with that. But you know, you have to work your wheel pants a little bit, and that's, you know, kind of annoying. But as I said earlier, the smaller turf fields will call to you when you're flying a Sonics, and the larger 5x5s really, really work good in that respect. So that's my, don't buy the retreads or the recaps, buy the 5x5s, you'll be happy. And it is heavier. I really haven't seen a difference on the cruise performance, although I know it's there, but I really haven't been able to tell. The other thing that you got to be careful about on 5x5s is when you do rework your wheel pants, they're going to set a little bit higher from the axle line to the top of the wheel pant, just because you've got a larger tire in there. And that helps you on rough fields too. So those things together. But I really haven't seen cruise performance detriment.
Well, Robert, I kind of agree with you on half of that. I pretty much fly naked now, which means I haven't had wheel pants on my plane now for quite a while. And if there was a cruise speed difference between with or without just the pants themselves, I never could determine that. Now, I would say there is a significant problem if I don't have the fairing on the gear legs. But when we talk about the retread tires, I know we've had this discussion before. My last plane, a Mall, I used retreads in those. And actually, I never really did have a problem at all with any balancing issue. I just put the 5x5s and my Sonics, as we mentioned. And I did buy retreads again for those too, because I had a good experience or a positive experience the first time. You know, I'll let you know what happens when I get to go for a test flight, whether or not I do have the same problem you do. But I'm crossing my fingers and toes and hoping that the retreads this time will work for me as well as they did in the past.
Well, I hope you're right. I mean, maybe I just got a bad set of tires, but, you know, to avoid that, it doesn't cost that much more.
Yeah, but I'm looking at this with these new tires in this plane, and I'm almost thinking, boy, this even looks like more of a real plane. Just, I like the stance of it. I like the looks of it.
Yeah.
And like I said, I don't care for the wheel pants anyway. I've had a lot of difficulty with those, trying to keep them in place and keep them from getting torn up and requiring, you know, reworking of the fiberglass and putting shims and backing plates and everything else in there anyway. So if I have to, you know, sacrifice a 2, 3, even 5 miles an hour, I mean, over a 10-hour flight time, what's that, an extra 20 minutes of flight time to get there?
Yeah, what are you guys looking at for costs on doing that versus the stock tires?
Well, they're a little bit more expensive. I can tell you, I kind of wish that I had waited another couple of days, because someone else posted there on the builder site, too. I buy my tires from Desser. and ordered a tire and a tube. And the replacement cost for both, you know, for both of them was almost about $225 or so. And now, of course, for the Black Friday, Thursday, Thanksgiving Day stuff, they were throwing in free inner tubes, which would have cut the price in half.
Oh, yeah. The inner tubes are quite expensive on those, aren't they?
Oh, they've always been expensive. And we never really figured out why you pay the same price for inner tube as you do for a tire.
Yeah, rough planning factors. You figure $50 for the tire, $50 for the tube. So a set of tires and tubes is going to be $200, and that's double what it's going to cost in a Sonics. Actually, more than double in a Sonics.
Yeah, I think the original Shenzhen's what are like $35, $40 or something.
Yeah, and the tubes are like $10.
Yeah. And like I said, I got almost 800 hours. I mean, 800 landings out of mine, so they were great price, great investment.
Well, I do a lot of takeoff and landings also, and I think I totaled mine up, and I was at 700 landings a couple of months ago, and they're going strong. I'll probably fly them for, I don't know, another 50 hours or so before I really even look at rotating them. They're holding up great. Really like them. I use McCreary AirHawk 5x5s and Aero Classic Leak Guard tubes, and I'm pretty happy with that combination. And we kind of touched on this, wheel pants. Wheel pants, obviously, they affect the look of the airplane. Some people love it. Some people are somewhat indifferent to it. They will give you somewhat improved performance. Like a lot of things, the performance difference is not going to be real extreme, especially with wheel pants. If you measure it carefully, you're going to find that it will slow you down. But if you're not measuring it carefully, will you notice it? Maybe, maybe not. Probably not. And if you are going to put bigger tires, it's one additional step that you need to do to prepare your wheel pants to really properly accept that larger tire. And it's a whole lot easier to do that up front rather than to go back and scrape all the paint off and modify your wheel pants and then repaint them after the fact. So you may want to consider that if you're thinking about it and it's a possibility that you might want to go to larger tires with your wheel pants, you may want to go ahead and just modify them now before you finish all your painting and have to come back later. All right, let's run through some of the challenges that that builders typically encounter. And first up is drilling the titanium gear legs. So, John, you've done this a couple of times now. Talk us through that.
Actually, I only drilled my tri-gear set. And in the tri-gear, you basically put the gear leg into the fixture that's in your that's under the that's attached to your spar, and mark the where you're going to be drilling through on the gear leg. Pull it out, then put it in the drill press in a vise or in a holder. And then I just used a brand new cobalt bit, some cutting oil, and I pre-drilled in a pilot hole just so that it wouldn't walk on me. And you know, watch the YouTube or it was the EAA builder thing where Carrie drills one, and just followed his instructions, just using low pressure and continuous feed in. It made some beautiful titanium curls as it went through, and just kept oiling it, and went real clean. That's the upper gear. Then for the bottom one, you know, you have to you mark it, you align the sockets at the bottom, and according to the plans, mark it, and then do the same thing down there.
Yeah, there's definitely a few things you have to do when drilling titanium. One, you absolutely need a sharp bit, and two, you absolutely have to keep the bit cutting without spinning and work hardening the titanium. And that's where the cutting fluid comes in. And Bob, you had mentioned a tip for doing that. Talk us through that.
Yeah, this was on actually a home builder's tips. But what I did on mine was I drilled my pilot hole using a 1/8 inch pilot hole using lots of fluid. But I didn't go all the way through. I set my drill press so there was maybe a 1/16 of an inch to go. And then what I did was, when I upsized to 1/4 inch, I filled that hole with cutting oil. So there was always a reservoir of oil at the tip of the 1/4 inch bit. And You just keep filling that. You have to, you go about a 16th or an 8th of an inch at a time as you're going through the titanium. And then you fill that hole up with cutting oil, and it keeps the bit nice and lubricated. It keeps the titanium nice and cool, and you go through. Now, what you will get when you finally break through is there will be a little chipping on the bottom side, and all you have to do with that is when you get done, you rotate it, get a larger bit, and just clean that chipping up a little bit with a larger bit, and it makes it nice and smooth. You get a beautiful hole. I did all 6 of my holes with a new Harbor Freight cobalt bit, and so it worked fine. Actually, I needed 2 1/8-inch bits to go through, but the quarter inch, it worked fine, and there was there's a big pool of oil at the end of the work, but the holes just worked out very nice.
And if you see smoke coming out of your hole, it's probably too late for your bit. Probably the best thing to do is add more fluid and get a new bit, because you absolutely have to cut through that work hardened layer. Otherwise, you will smoke that bit and it is done. Gary, any particular challenges or tips on doing that?
No, not on the drilling itself. Like I said, I think if you look at some of the Yay videos, they'll help you out. You know, some people do talk about making just a small flat spot where you need to drill, just to kind of keep the drill bit from walking to, you know, if there's other way that you can do it, like, you know, Bob Micah said about doing a little small pilot to start with. That's probably the biggest thing, because you're trying to drill on a curvature. So you want to make sure your bit doesn't start walking off.
Yeah, right. And it'll hit it and kind of glance off to one side or the other. So you're talking about filing a little flat to get the bit started in, or possibly a center punch mark or something like that.
I use the center punch.
Okay, the next challenge, I think, is setting the proper alignment and toe-in. And how does the plans specify that?
Gosh, honestly, I don't really remember at this point. It's been quite
it's
a while
been
back.
So long. I don't know, but I got it right.
yeah, and I think that can cause a lot of grief or a lot of problem with shimmies and tracking and so forth. My approach was pretty much probably archaic at best. I know a lot of you new guys like to use, you know, fancy lasers and so forth, but I just basically used big, long carpenter levels, leveled up my longerons on the top where the cockpit is, you know, fore, aft, and sideways, so I had a level surface. I then put some long levels perpendicular to that and dropped plumb bobs down from each end in order to set my axles at the right specification, and that worked for me.
Well, the plans, they show putting a long straight edge. You can use a 2x4 or a piece of pipe or something long and straight on the back side of the axles. They give you a piece of steel tubing that you slip over the axle, and that takes up a little bit of space at the base, at the root side of the axle, and then you kind of rotate the axle so that the back contacts your straight edge. And that has the effect of setting your toe in properly. And actually, now that I think about it, it might not be on the back side of the axle, it may be on the front side of the axle. But the plans are very specific on slip those collars over. They're already sized right for you. They slip right over the axles. And then you just have to have that plane that sets both the gear legs at the same angle in the same alignment. The challenge with that method is that the gear legs themselves are in your way. And so it's very hard to get them in there and properly set. So you can use a couple of standoffs. You can use a variety of other methods to kind of get that plane clear of the interference of the gear leg and the socket itself. I think no matter what you do, this is an area where you got to take your time. And if you use one method, such as the collar, the spacer that the kit includes, then before you drill it, back it up with a second one. Drop your plumb bobs. Use a laser level on the outsides of your wheels to project center lines. Do some other method to cross-check, and check it a few times before you really commit to drilling those holes. Once you drill it, you're going to live with whatever you got until you decide to go in and fix it. Now, if you do have to fix it, how do we do that?
Well, one method would be to buy new sockets and just re-drill the outer socket in a different alignment. You could also weld in the holes you've pre-drilled and in the socket and, you know, grind it flush and then re-drill them.
And Sonics allows you to take your gear leg, rotate it 90 degrees, and re-drill new holes through it. They say that the old hole is not going to be a problem. It's not going to degrade the strength. But if you screw it up a second time, now you've got crisscrossing holes, and it's pretty hard to recover from that. You might be buying new gear legs.
Or just go with a shorter version, perhaps.
Yeah, and bigger tires.
Right. Okay, and then so the other challenge on my list here is properly seating the wheel bearing into the races. So I think that the key there is that you're going to have this bearing. It comes not set in the wheel hub itself. You're going to have to grease it up, and then you're going to have to press it down into the wheel to get it to sit flush. If you don't do this, one, it's not going to operate as designed, and two, when you put the dust cover on, you're going to have a significant gap, and that's going to throw off your spacing on your brakes. It's going to allow dirt and contaminants to get into your wheel bearings, and it's generally just going to be wrong. What we're talking about doing is pressing that into the wheel hub so that it's fully seated and working properly. If it's fully seated, you're going to have very minimal gap between the dust cover and the bearings themselves. How's the best way here? What's the best practice on seating that bearing?
Well, I've done it like I did all my boat trailer bearings. You take the hub, put it on a hard surface like your concrete floor, gently tap it in with the wood to get it started, and then take a socket that's either the same size or just slightly smaller and lightly tap it in. What'll happen is it'll be kind of a dull sound as it taps, but once it seats, it'll ring. So you'll know that it's fully seated when that pitch changes. And that's the way I've always done it.
Yeah, I was a fan of the large socket system as well.
And this is a really simple operation. This is not rocket science here.
I wouldn't use a press because that aluminum cast wheel, you'll probably break it trying to seat it unless you have it supported properly.
Well, you could probably use one of the simple arbor presses, which I use later on in my build. It's not hydraulic. It's just simply a mechanical arm, a geared arm. Give you quite a bit of control press without having, you know, tons and tons of force on there.
Yeah, I think any of those is an acceptable way. There is a wrong way to do it. There's actually two wrong ways to do it. First is to ignore altogether and just call it good enough, and it's not properly seated, and you're going to have wobble, you're going to have premature bearing wear, and generally it's going to be a crappy installation. The other wrong way to do it is just to crank down on the nut holding the wheel on. Just keep cranking that thing down until it seems to stop, and all you're going to do is just squish the balls into the races, and you're going to potentially damage them. And again, you're going to have premature bearing wear because you seriously stress those ball bearings, and they're gonna wear on you. So do it right. Use a press or use a socket and tap it lightly, but do something and make sure those things are properly seated. And again, you'll know if the dust cover is close to flush, then you're good to go. All right, so moving into the issues, let's talk about a few issues that commonly crop back up. First one, Bob, you've got some experience with this, and that is landing gear bolts breaking. So talk to us about that.
Well, I had the original, I guess, bolt break on the stainless steel bolts. And actually, it was Rick Wants that spotted it at one of our Sonics, Midwest Sonics fly-ins. It was a... I've got some pictures on my site that you guys can look at. But it was
which bolt are we talking about?
Huh?
Which bolt are we talking about?
Oh, we're talking about the top bolt in the gear leg, and it was a torsional issue. It was just cranked down too hard, and they finally figured out that the cadmium plating only reacts with titanium at some unbelievable, like 400 degrees or something like that, which we'll never see. So now we've got, you know, the regular bolts. Now, one of the things that I did when I changed out my bolts was B&B Hardware is just down the road from us, and I went down there and I took my calipers and I asked to go through the whole bin, and I got a variety of bolts, and I've got tight fit bolts now, even though I'm using standard bolts, and you can actually do that if you have a source to do that with. But I grease them all up with axle grease before I put them in, because there will be, even though, you know, you've got your powder coat issue there, I grease up all bolts that are hidden from view. And that's how I fixed that. I got the AN bolt in there now.
What we're talking about is originally Sonic specified stainless steel bolts in contact with the titanium. Anywhere that there was a titanium, the bolt that went through titanium, it was a stainless steel. And that's sort of an aerospace best practice, just to avoid cadmium in contact with titanium. Well, what they later determined is that the stainless steel bolts really weren't as strong, and that was causing a little bit of a problem. So in your case, a broken bolt, where a stronger traditional AN bolt would have had no problem carrying that load. So they issued a service bulletin that said, scratch the stainless steel bolts, just go ahead and use cadmium bolts. It's not that big of a deal at the temperatures we're operating, and the added strength is going to solve that problem. So you're talking about greasing them up, sticking them in, and then having no further problem.
That's right.
And John, you've also had those main bolts that hold the gear leg to the axle, or to the gear leg to the engine mount. You've had some issue with those bolts as well.
Yeah, mine was due to fretting. And so what happened was I had a small burr in the motor mount. And so when flying with the axle unweighted, the bolt would vibrate in that hole, and it fretted a line around the bolt, and after multiple landings, it finally sheared, and the gear leg turned on me.
Oh wow!
it put me into the. It was at the very end of my rollout, so it just put me onto the side of the runway, and I was able to tow it back in. But I pulled the bolt out, took pictures, sent it to Sonics, and they said, "Yep, that's a fretting issue. You've got a burr in there that you need to take care of." And so what I've done since then is it's just part of my annual. I swap the bolt. I just pull it out. It's a dollar a bolt, and put a fresh bolt in at every annual now and inspect it to make sure that I got that burr out.
Or probably even at the very least on your annual, try rotating the bolt and make sure that the opposite end rotates as well as the head. Just make sure it's not broken in half.
Well, that'll tell you if it's broken, but it won't tell you if it's fretting.
That's true. But I'm saying at the very least, just at least rotate it.
It's not that big of a deal. I mean, you already have the plane jacked up to do the brakes and things. You can pull that bolt out, take a look at it, and then put another one in, or put the same one back in. But
Robert and I talked before. I think the plans had originally called for these things to be inserted aft to fore, and that can cause some problems actually trying to retract and retrieve those bolts and take them out on a regular basis.
Right, I didn't do that. I didn't follow the plans that way. I went the opposite, forward to aft, which makes it easier to take out.
I actually did follow the plans, but what I did was I drilled a hole in the firewall, and then I put a patch in the firewall so that I could pull it out that way. I mean, six of one, half dozen another.
Yeah, and might come in from the front towards the rear, and that way I can pull them out. At year three, when I did my annual, I wanted to get a look at those bolts. I had 150 hours or so, and I wanted to see if there's any appreciable wear. So, like you said, John, you've already got it jacked up, so I just pulled that thing out, got a good look at it, and just to reassure myself that there are no problems developing. And I think that's probably good advice. Just periodically, I don't know how frequently you need to do it, but periodically you ought to just have a look at them just to make sure that there's not a problem developing. Okay, and then we've also had a little bit of problem with the lower bolt, the one that holds the actual axle socket to the lower part of the gear leg. We've had a problem at that end, too. Bob, what are we talking about there?
Okay, well, because of the vibration on my out-of-round tire, I got a lot of wear on the landing gear fixture going into the titanium rod, and it actually hogged out that hole. So what I did was I had a guy weld a sleeve on my gear, and then I had to re-drill it. I would actually recommend the builders that before you drill your landing gear fixture, that you weld that sleeve on there. What that does is that gives you, it gives the bolt more meat, for the loads that it will see as it goes between the titanium and the steel. It doesn't weigh hardly anything. It's easy to do when you're doing that and you're drilling the whole thing. And so you're going through, you know, four layers instead of two layers of 4130. Since I've done mine, it hasn't, of course, I fixed the wheel wobble too, but, it hasn't done anything. But I would recommend that as a standard, thing to put on your landing gear fixture. And that will, I don't see how it could wobble out or hog out with that extra meat on there. Now, if you, you know, if you don't have, you know, shimmy or shake on your wheel, that the steel as it's spec'd will probably work fine. But if you do, you might be fixing it.
Those sockets on the gear legs on the axle part are only 40 or 50 thousandths thick. And again, like you said, if the hole is not a perfect fit on the bolt, and it can move a little bit, any kind of shimmy or weird loading on the gear is just gonna, it's gonna rattle and it's gonna exacerbate that and it's gonna hog out over time. If your hole is perfect, you probably have nothing to worry about. But it's a very easy thing to fix, to weld on a reinforcing collar over that old hole, or even like you say at the beginning, weld it on ahead of time so when you drill it, you're drilling right through both at the beginning. Probably a good idea to at least to think about and keep in the back of your head if you do have a problem. It's a, there's a known way to fix it. Gary, any issues with that on yours?
Well, not that I've noticed so far. Yeah, no, I'd really like to say not at this moment, but I'll let you know how my annual comes out here in the next couple of weeks too.
I know that another builder reported that he had drilled those lower landing gear, the socket side. And something happened. Either the drill shifted a little bit, it didn't go through exactly right, and that hole was all elongated and just chewed up. And so rather than trying upsizing to an AN5 bolt to hold that socket on, he welded it closed, cleaned up the inside, welded on a reinforcing collar, and re-drilled it. So effectively, that's what he's got now. But it's just it's a good spot to make sure that you've done it properly and your holes are good. Just make sure that it's good right from the start. And if not, go in and fix it right. Don't wait for you to have a gear leg that's rattling around and causing problems. John, when your gear leg rotated, what did it do to the airplane?
It rotated the tire over onto its onto the axle face, so it destroyed my wheel pant. But I wasn't going, you know, more than walking pace. So that's the only damage that was to the aircraft at all.
So that's the, that came through it pretty well. But even then, a destroyed wheel pant and the time to get it all fixed up, definitely worth doing properly from the beginning.
Oh yeah, definitely. Now I have the Tracy O'Brien gear legs and that has the welded on axle sockets. So you don't have that lower wallowing problem.
Mm-hmm. Right. The next issue, we've talked about it briefly, is gear shimmy. So the shimmy, you're going to feel it typically on the runway. It'll be at a certain speed and under a certain condition. You might be just after landing as you're decelerating through a certain speed, and for a few miles an hour, you feel it shimmying on you. It could be the opposite. It could be when you're accelerating, you might pass through it, or even in the air, you might feel some shimmy. Bob, when you had your out of balance tires, what did that feel like?
Oh, it felt like the plane was coming apart. When you watch my video, I even put the little four white lines on the gear, and it was funny. On turf, the wheel would spin up. Well, on takeoff, I wouldn't get any shimmy at all. On landing on pavement, I would get very bad shimmy because the wheel would spin up immediately as soon as it hit the pavement. When I landed on turf, the wheel would spin up slower because as you're coming onto the grass, it starts to feel the grass first and then it spins up. And I had very little shimmy on turf. So there was, you know, there was a residence point there that was really bad. And, you'll see, I mean, the gear is displacing 6 inches at the axle, back and forth. It was very bad.
So it's flopping now that I got all over.
It was terrible, and it was doing a number on my fairing too. But now that it's, you know, now they got a balanced wheel, it's no problem.
Yeah, and like you said, that can tear up other things. It can loosen those bolts. It can hog out the holes. It can tear up your wheel pants. There's a lot of things that a shimmy can do.
Yep.
It also could be caused by just a bad alignment. If you didn't set your toe in properly, especially if it's uneven, one side is significantly different than the other. That can give you some really weird, funky ground handling, and it can be a problem as the tires are essentially fighting each other.
Yeah, and one of the ways you can tell that is it easier to turn one way or the other? Because you can tell which side, which side is more out of the line by which way you can turn.
Maybe a third cause, too, for shimming, as we may have mentioned before, might be in assembling the two halves of those Azusa wheels. They don't seem to line up as well as we'd like to. And I noticed when I was doing my tires today, I was fortunate enough I was able to find a 14-millimeter socket that I could just get in there, and it was like a perfect wedge in there to try to get those two halves lined up while I'm torquing down the bolts, the through bolts.
Right, and Bob, you actually made a specific tool to do exactly that, to align those wheel halves.
Actually, Charlie Radford did it for me. We measured the interior dimension of both of my wheels, and they were off by a couple of thousandths. So we took a piece of pipe, and Charlie Radford is a great machinist. And if you have a hammer, everything is a nail. If you've got a lathe, everything is, everything is turned. So he turned that piece of pipe, so I could put that in the two halves and bolt them down. But the socket, probably use the deep socket for that, and that would work just as well.
You may assemble it one time, say when you're initially putting your wheels together, you may assemble it, and you might get it just right and never even think about it, never even realize that there's possibly a problem. And then you have to service your wheels, and you've got it all broken apart for whatever reason, and the next time you go to put it back together, now they're not lined up right, and now all of a sudden you can't figure out what's changed. It's just something to be aware of, and whatever you can do to get those to accurately go back together and line up properly is going to save that frustration down the road, especially when you're trying to figure out what changed and you don't know it. Lastly, on the issues list is damaged fiberglass wheel fairings, and we talked about this can happen from a shimmy or an unbalanced tire. What we're talking about most commonly is the outer screw that goes into the end of the axle. It's a single point attachment on that side of the wheel pant. That hole that screw goes through is under a lot of stress, and if you get any sort of vibration in the wheel pant, even just from taxiing over pavement, that thing can the screw can hog out the hole in the fiberglass and just tear a big old hole in it. It's so bad that the fairing itself is just flopping around. And so the solution there is to go in and add some sort of reinforcement to the fiberglass to help spread that load out.
I've done a couple of things. And the first time I glassed in something just on the inside, and that wasn't enough. Currently, and you can see this on my sites, I have two elliptical, well, they're not quite elliptical, plates. And the one on the inside is glassed in, but I also have two machine screws that hold it in place. And then the third machine screw is the one that actually goes into the axle. And since I've done that, those are 25 thousandths on the outside and on the inside. It hasn't moved a bit. That's probably overkill. But after my fun with floppy tires, that is what I did, and I'm very happy with it.
On my previous wheel pants, I glassed in large diameter AN washers, and I thought that was a pretty good solution until one of my wheel pants hogged out an enormous hole big enough for that entire washer. The washer was stuck to the screw, but it just broke it free. So now I use a thicker plate, larger in diameter, make sure it's glassed in properly, and I haven't had any problems since. Gary, any problems on yours?
Oh, absolutely. I've had to redo my pants a couple of times. They would crack on the inside and wallow out the outside where the axle is. And I did pretty much what a lot of guys did. I fiberglassed in some large area washers on the inside. I used large area washers on the outside. It looks a little funkier. But I thought anything that I could do to spread the clamping force outside the traditional size of the head of an AN bolt would be helpful. Even then, though, after a period of time, I still find these things tend to loosen up. You lose screws. I actually had to start carrying spare screws for a while just so when I landed someplace I could walk around. If I needed to, I'd have an extra one to throw back in. That's one reason I kind of just go naked now, so I'm not worried about redoing my particular pants, even going with the 5x5 tires today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another one of those areas, much easier to do it from the start. I think a smart builder is going to anticipate problems, and they're going to glass in reinforcements during the original construction and then just call it good. Okay, so wrapping up this topic, let's go through a few of the custom mods that people tend to do. The first one is the steering link that connects the rudder drive horn to the tailwheel, and doing some sort of custom link rod. The standard one that comes in the kit is just a welded tube with a couple of flats on each end. And the idea is you drill a hole in this flat and then just connect it with a bolt that just goes right through the drive horn. It's effective. It rides on the bolt itself. But over time, it will tend to wallow out either the link rod itself, unlikely because it's made out of steel, or more likely, the drive horn, which is made out of eighth-inch aluminum. So a lot of people, I think, are uncomfortable with that right from the start, and so they want to put a different style of link rod. Bob, what did you do on yours?
Well, I had two that I worked on. The first one was the ball-in bearing on the thing, and that worked okay. But over time, there was some Y-axis loading on the tab that comes out from the tailwheel assembly, and that actually bent down. So after I looked at that for a while, I took a piece of 1/2-inch solid aluminum rod, and I bent it in a serpentine fashion so that as it goes down and the force loads into the tailwheel assembly, it only gets X-axis loading. And since then, the tab has not bent a bit. So you've got, your standard ball-in connection up at the drive horn, and then it serpentines down to the thing. And that's worked out really well. The tricky part about this is you have to figure what your distance is. You got to bend the rod. Then you got to cut it off. You got to drill it and tap it, and that is a little bit tricky. But if you get it done right, and you might just buy a couple of sticks of half-inch rod and play with it, it works out really well. It's worked out really well for me, and I have had no problems with the tab bending at all. And you can see that on my site.
Yeah,
I haven't noticed any bending, but I am starting to see a little bit of wallowing too now at my rear attachment. I think I'm anticipating it being able just to be able to fix that with a bushing for the bolt to go through and take up the slack again.
Yeah, I did. Charlie Radford machined some bushings for both of our airplanes, and I've got a bushing in mine too.
And I put bushings in on mine during the build.
On mine, I made up just a straight link rod. I've got a ball end on the drive horn and another ball end attached to the drive arm on the tailwheel, and then the link rod just connects them. But what Bob's talking about is the drive horn sits quite a bit higher than the steering arm. The steering arm is right close to the ground, and the drive horn is at least a foot off the ground. And so this link rod is angled between the two. And if you make it in kind of an S shape, now each end of the S is parallel with the ground. So you come out parallel from the drive horn, you S your way down to the tailwheel side, and you come in parallel to the tailwheel arm. And it just keeps any kind of like loading from, especially landing tailwheel first, when the tailwheel tries to flex on landing, it's gonna push against that link rod. Well, if you put the S shape in, that never has any problem. It never tries to bend the arm. And that's a much more elegant design. Mine is straight. I haven't noticed any bending yet. But I have in the past, and so it's just something that I watch for at annual time. Mine is just a piece of, I don't know, it's 1/2-inch or 3/8 chromoly tubing, and I just took a couple of
bolt threads, and I cut the head off the bolt and shoved them up in there and welded them in place. And that's about it. It cost about $10 to make, and I just bought the inexpensive rod ends, and super easy. And you can adjust it for the right length, so you don't have to hit it exactly perfect. You just got to get it within about a half an inch, and definitely makes it easier to get that thing lined up and no wallowing out on mine. One of the other mods that you can do is your gear leg fairings. So the standard plans gear leg fairing attachment method is to use the hinge pin that joins the fairing to lock that gear leg fairing in place. There's a variety of ways to do this. You can have multiple pins that meet in the middle. You can have attachment tabs that hold that gear leg fairing in place. There's a wide variety of methods to attach that gear leg fairing. Bob, how did you do your gear leg fairing?
Well, I did the two-pin method where it's in the middle, and you go up, you know, each way from the center. One of the things that I did, though, was after I made it, I took the temper out of the gear leg fairing by putting it together and then running a torch over the part with the high radius. That makes it a lot easier to squeeze together. It's a big difference. To hold it in place, I put a little tab on the bottom of the fuselage with a nut plate, and it just, you have to kind of adjust it, and then you figure out where to put the little tab and the nut plate, and then that just holds it up. So you go, you know, from the center up and down, and then you screw the bearing to the little tab, and it works out fine. But taking the temper out of the aluminum makes it a much easier installation process.
Yeah, those gear legs, when you wrap them around, they're really springy, and so it puts a lot of stress on the hinge pin trying to hold that thing together. It makes it hard to bend it precisely the way you want it.
Yeah, and well, actually, I had it all bent before I took the temper out of it. Actually, I would probably take the temper out of it, you know, before I bent it this time, or if I had to do it again. But it's much easier to align it with the temper out, or install it with the temper out of it.
Bob, maybe you ought to just describe what you actually mean by taking the temper out of it, how you actually accomplished that.
Okay, well, I've got a photograph of it on my website. But what I did was I took the gear fairing, I inserted the pins, I clamped it to my bench, and then I took a propane torch, one of those little, you know, hardware store torches, and I just played it across the front of the fairing for about, oh, I don't know, 3-4 minutes, and just let it cool, and then that took the temper out of that part of the metal just by heating it up like that. In fact, I did it. I use on my airplane, I'm using the blue is old Ford blue, and it's actually engine block enamel, and I did it with the paint on it. And I never got it over 500 degrees, which is what they say that the engine block enamel is good for. And so I actually took the temper out of the gear fairing with the paint on it. I would not recommend that, but I got lucky.
Well, I think I've seen some people recommend just basically using the blue felt tip pins that we use, the highlighters or whatever. I'm
drawing
a blank right now.
Yeah,
Sharpies. Thank you. Using the Sharpies to draw your line up there, heating that until the Sharpie disappears. Is that something you guys have heard or used as well?
Yeah, that's what I've used. Works. Is just to squiggle even a black Sharpie across where you want to heat it, then just use the torch to make the lines go away. Just try to make it even, and that takes the temper right out. You'll never get it back in.
And over time, 6061 will it'll age harden. So it happens slowly. And it'll take on a more of a set after several months. So if you're worried about degrading the strength of the metal, it's definitely going to be softer and more malleable, which is what you want. And over time, it's going to firm back up. And so there's not going to be a big problem on something like a fairing. Structural part would be a little different. You wouldn't really want to do that.
Yeah, this is just cosmetic. I don't think you have to worry about any structural aspects to it.
Yeah, I did the same thing with the fairing back at the tail. I took 100% of the. By the time I was done with that, it was dead soft. It's a lot easier to form.
John, how are you holding your fairings in place?
I use the two-pin method. Initially, I had a longer pin that went up through a hole drilled in the floor of the cockpit, but I found that either the pin would work its way down and it would come out of that hole, or just the flexing on a bad landing would pop that pin out of that hole up in the fairing. Since then, I've made cuffs for the intersection between the top of the gear leg and the cowl, and that holds it in place now with a couple of screws.
I'm a fan of the cuff method also. It just kind of wraps around the fairing and locks it right in place. It also cleans up the look and just kind of gives it a nice custom appearance.
Yeah, I like the look too. The only negative thing is I got to remove that to remove the cowl.
As we close this topic out, let's just do some final thoughts here. So, Bob, I'm going to turn it over for you. Any final thoughts or advice to builders when they're doing their landing gear considerations?
Just take your time. It'll all work out. It's fun to do. Always check your alignment, not twice, but three times. And if there's a builder in your area, even one that hasn't finished, have him come in and you can both talk about it and you may solve a problem that you have caused yourself. So a second set of eyes is always good, and go fly your airplane.
John, any final thoughts?
No, what's been said is take your time. Even if you screw up, there are fixes. I wouldn't be too nervous about trying to do something, but definitely measure twice or three times and drill once.
Yeah, absolutely. Gary, final thoughts?
Bigger wheels, bigger tires.
I see someone else has the big wheel envy.
Yeah. You're not making it easy for me at Christmas, I'm telling you guys.
Yeah, really. we're gonna put it under the tree for you.
No, you'll put one under and make me go buy the other one.
Well, you know, we'll
that
help you out.
That would look funny.
You can only turn right.
Yeah.
I guess my final thoughts are along the lines of what you said, Bob. Take your time, think it through, and then if something goes wrong, be honest about it. Don't rationalize it away. If you misdrill a hole and it's a little bit wobbly, you probably ought to do something and fix it. Don't think, well, it's probably kind of sort of going to be good enough and I'll just go fly it and try it out. Fix it right. Do it right from the beginning. Be honest about a problem that may be encountered in construction and save yourself a ton of grief down the road having to come back after you've painted it and are trying to fly it and having to fix one of these problems. A lot of these things can be tracked to an initial thing that maybe you had no idea that was wrong, but maybe there was that little voice in the back of your head that was telling you, oh, this may not be the best thing. Listen to that voice. Do it right from the beginning. That's my final thought on that.
I have a confession to make to all of you.
But we won't tell anybody, Bob. This is just between the three of us.
No, actually, you can publish this. When I was first building my ribs, one of the first things I did, I built all of my forward ribs 1/32 of an inch too narrow. And I sat down with myself after I built the rear ribs. I said, Bob, what are you going to do about this? And I said, you're going to redo the forming blank, and you're going to build them right. So I had to build all the front ribs again. And I used the rejects as door prizes. So there are people out there that have my first ribs. They're all scattered across the Midwest. But that's the kind of attitude you have to have if you're going to build a good airplane.
Absolutely. Be honest with yourself, and you know, there's a trick to knowing what's important and what's really not important. But those things that are important, you really got to listen to that voice, and you got to do them right. So good job on recognizing that and taking the time to go back and do it properly. All right, well, I think we wrapped this topic up pretty well. Let's go out. Anybody got shout-outs?
Well, Jeff, I'd like to compliment you on putting together the turkey shoot. That was a lot of fun today.
Yeah, that was. It was just sort of a last-minute idea, but, hey, you got to take advantage of those targets of opportunity and get together and go commune with the rest of the Sonics builders in the area, and I had a great time. Absolutely and thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to coming back in May, and we'll hit the next fly-in out here. And then not too long after that, we're going to have the Mile High fly-in, so that's going to be a good time too.
You're putting all the pressure on us, Jeff.
I was wondering if you were going to say anything or just kind of let that one go.
Well, I was going to let it go, but I got to say something.
All right. Well, my shout out is the Quiet Technologies Halo headsets. I put a post on Sonics Builders a few days ago. I am thoroughly impressed with these headsets. I was a little bit nervous about trying to wear an in-ear style earplug headset for long periods of time. Sometimes I have a hard time with those little foamy earplugs. They feel like they're expanding inside and giving me a headache. Not the case with the Quiet Technology. The different size of ear tips will fit, I think, anybody's ears. These things are super comfortable. You forget you're wearing them. And man, it is so nice to not have a heavy headset on when you're doing aerobatics and your head is moving around or you're never bumping into the canopy with them. I just absolutely love them. So I think this is probably the last style of headset I'm going to buy in a long, long time. Thoroughly enjoy them.
And they're not hot in the summer.
No, you feel like you're flying barefoot. I mean, it's wonderful.
Yeah, I got a pair too, and I've had them for 3 years. And if I lose these, I've got an extra set for my son. I'll use those, and then I'll have to buy another set.
Price is really affordable. They run about $350 a set. The ear tips, you can reuse them multiple times, and you can even take them and wash them and get a little bit more life out of them. But when they're worn out after a month or two or whatever, they're $150 a set. So you pull them off, and you chuck them in the trash, and you order up a few more sets from Quiet Technologies, and that is pretty darn, you know, efficient flying. I ordered another 10 of them, so I'm good for the next year or two.
Are you using the yellow ones or the orange ones?
The little beige ones, the smallest diameter ones.
Okay.
I've got very small ear canals, so the big fat yellow ones are just, I mean, my kids use them, but those little beige ones are perfectly comfortable, and I have a hard time finding anything small enough for me, so really good. The other thing which is interesting is I have an MGL V6 radio, and I was always having a little bit of odd performance. I never really thought it was a real great radio, and I acknowledge that part of that might have been my old Lightspeed headset. I have an old passive Lightspeed that's been working pretty good for years and years. But it just didn't really work great with the V6. So I was actually considering removing the V6 and putting in a different style of radio. And now that I'm using these, the audio is so much clearer, and you can turn the volume way down and still hear it. Blocks out all that engine noise, and it's just super easy. And now I love the radio. And so it was never really the radio that was the problem. It was really my old crappy headset was just not working really well in the Sonics. So that if anybody is out there listening and they are considering the purchase of a new headset, you can go spend $1,000 on a premium Lightspeed or a Bose, or you might find that these things are very, very satisfactory. So that's my shout out, Quiet Technology. So well done on the Halo. Gary, John, anything?
Nope. Actually, I think I'm good.
Me too.
All right. Well, hey, good job, guys. Bob, thanks for sticking around and running through this with us. Always good to talk to you. Look forward to seeing you again next time. Our next episode is going to be show number 10. We are looking to do the topic of documenting your Sonics project. We've got a couple of people lined up to talk us through that. We're going to talk about doing a website like Kitlog or Expertcraft, doing a custom website. Or just doing a photo site, kind of like what you're doing, Bob. So we're going to run through some options and show you what's out there and how to make the most of it.
This episode, you can find the show notes with the links to the videos. We'll put the titanium drilling video that Sonics has on there. We'll put Bob's videos in, of his out-of-balance tires and links to his photo albums. You can find any of those other stories that we talked about in the news. You can find that at www.sonicsflight.com/9. And you can find us on iTunes, Google Play, and any of the other podcast apps out there. If you get a chance, go in there and leave a review. We were just kind of talking that people are starting to kind of hear about the show, but a few reviews out there maybe will help spread the word. And we want to make sure that people are enjoying this and giving us some good feedback, and leave us a review and tell us what you think. So with that, I'm going to say thanks again, everybody. Really appreciate it. Good conversation. And I'm looking forward to doing it next time. You guys have a great evening and fly safely.
All right. Good night.
Thanks a lot. Good night, guys.
The views and opinions expressed on the Sonics Flight podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and do not necessarily reflect the views of any individual, company, or organization mentioned on this program. Nothing presented on this podcast should be construed to be the official position or recommendation of anyone not directly associated with Sonics Flight. Anything that sounds like advice should be carefully considered before being implemented. Remember, you are the pilot in command.
All right. Well, you guys ready? You stocked up on drinks and all the pre-flights complete?
Well, I am short of beer, but we'll go ahead anyway. I'll suffer through it.
You know, it's 5 o'clock on the East Coast, so
yeah.
I say you go for it.
I usually like to have at least one or two drinks while I'm trying to converse with you guys.
It helps bring you down to our level, I've noticed.
It does.